pull up the chair and sit down. Not often do we call the meeting or not often do we get to drag down the finance czars and humble them before
That's
us.
That's right. We should be kind of.
Yes. There are people that are today are dragging us down every day. It is. It'll be a fun day. Usually we just
We're gonna
have.
Yeah, I mean, we sit around and talk about sex crimes.
You know. That's right.
Well,
you've
gotten out your version of the budget. I can afford to be loose.
No, we're just waiting on the CS on our psychological equivalent of the budget.
Okay, let's go ahead and call the meeting to order. We're taking up House Bill 803 and act related to the adjudication of challenges to regulations of state agencies.
And we have Representative Cooper here this morning. Mr. Cooper, did you want a copy of the bill?
I kind of like one, Chairman.
Yeah, I think I know what the deal is. Basically, Mr. Chairman, I think every legislator gets a lot of complaints from the citizens about regulations and things like that. And right now, what you get to do if you don't like the regulation, you can call the legislature and maybe the administrative committee will move, and maybe they won't. And certainly it will be a little difficult, for instance, to get the administrative review committee together during, say, an election season. It'll be a little hard to get them to meet in October. I think that people ought to get a quick way to resolve the questions that are listed here, whether a regulation is constitutional, whether it's not in conformity with legislative intent, which is really the bulk of most of them, or it's unreasonable per se, or if it's unreasonable as applied to the petitioner, or if it hasn't been validly adopted. There ought to be a quick way to raise those questions. As things stand right now, what you have to do is exhaust all your administrative remedies. Then you have to go to the court system, and by the time you get any action, might be 4, 5, or 6 years, and you might find that if you don't have $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 to pay a lawyer, you might as well just forget it. And what this piece of legislation seeks to do, in any event, is to provide a quick remedy to people who have a complaint about regulations within this limited sense. I would think that if they just don't like the regulation, then they can go to the Administrative Review Committee. But these other questions, I think, are properly addressed by the courts, and they ought to be able to go immediately there. Frankly, an administrative council is no place. I'm not speaking of the committee, I'm speaking of the various routes of administrative appeal that people have to go to. That's no place to get a question on legislative intent decided, or the constitutionality of the statute, or the reasonableness of the regulation. You can't really get a decision there. And if you have those questions to be decided, you should be able to go direct to the court. And what I had in mind was the Chief Justice designating a judge to sit as a regulatory judge for whatever time is necessary in view of the number of complaints that are out. And it may be like 2 days a month in Anchorage, and 1 day a month in Fairbanks, and 1 day a month in Ketchikan and Bethel and so forth, depending on the volume. But that judge, when he's designated by the CJ, he's required to do this and nothing else. He doesn't get to say, well, I'll hear you in 1987 because I've got 4,000 criminal trials before I can get to you. He doesn't get to do that. He has to take these first. The guy who's got a complaint about a regulation comes in and pays his $100 to the clerk, and the clerk says, the clerk helps him fill out the forms. She sends him to some central place that the Chief Justice can check on when he's designating these judges to sit. It would work kind of like the Workers' Comp Board does, because they travel around to various towns and that kind of thing. Although here you wouldn't have to have a traveling judge, you could just use one in whatever place was. And then when the guy comes in, the clerk can say, okay, what's your complaint? What's the regulation you have a problem with? And she helps him fill out the form. The form gets filed, and she says, okay, the administrative law judge is coming next month on, you know, April the 9th, and you'll get a notice of that hearing. And the guy comes in, and the judge treats it much in the way of a workman's comp hearing. He tries to get out, you know, as many facts, if any, as are necessary for him to make the finding. But under this bill, except where the question is raised as to the reasonableness of the regulation, it'll all be a question of law anyway. And the judge should be able to decide that easily within 30 days. Now, I think the cost of it, what we should do is to add an extra clerk and an extra law clerk to help decide these questions, and perhaps Art Snowden would have a better idea as to how best to administer it. But the point is to get these things decided in a hurry so that people don't have to spend years and years and thousands of dollars when they have a regulation that might well be completely out of whack with legislative intent. Larry?
Thank you. I strongly support the bill, but I call your attention to page 2, lines 13 and 14. I wonder if two things shouldn't be done there in order to, one, make clear the language, and two, to avoid vexatious challenges of regulations. To the first point, I would suggest that it read on line 15, for all regulations challenged at one time within a single title in the last administrative code, mm-hmm. so that we know that the maximum is applied to what we're challenging at one time, rather than you can accumulate challenges within a single title up to the maximum. And I'd recommend that the maximum filing fee be raised from 100 to 200, and that the maximum, the not to exceed figure, should be $600. That would make it substantial enough to keep the vexatious part. I know this is an arbitrary thing, but I have a hunch that a person would think twice about $200. We're rapidly approaching the time in Alaska where we don't think all that much about $100. This is such an...
Well, it depends, Mr. Carpenter.
I see a great opportunity here for cranks to really be vexatious at great cost to the, relatively speaking, to the taxpayer. I want them to have this low-cost remedy, and I think it's very necessary. I just would up the ante a tad, as they say.
And, of course, they get it back if they win. Well, I think it's completely...
I'd like to confine the discussion just to question of Mr. Cooper, because he has to get back up.
Well, my question is, what does he think of your suggestion?
That's fine. I certainly think that your original suggestion on the at-one-time language probably ought to go in there. And I think the money is just a matter of policy. I think you might be right that it may be necessary to bring it up somewhere.
Mr.
Meyer?
This doesn't change the status of the Administrative Regulation Review Committee, though, okay?
No. They go there, too.
Yeah, they still have all the chingadairs that they have.
Yeah.
You know,
what?
Chingadairs.
That's a
term of art.
Who's art?
I think art.
Mrs. Wright.
I have several questions. First of all, you mentioned the desirability that the judge spend a day a month or something. Do you think it would be necessary or desirable to put that into the bill? If it says that the Chief Justice is requested to assign one or more judges, and I see the possibility under the bill as it's drafted of all of that, but the regulation adjudication falling behind everything else that's already in that judge's docket or whatever you call it, do you think it might be desirable to put some of the Chief Justice is requested to assign a judge who will spend a day a month or something like that?
I think it might be well to put it right out there to say that the Chief Justice should designate the Superior Court judges who are specifically assigned to that task for a certain period. period of time. Of course, it may be that this thing will grow so that they need a special judge, but I doubt it, because it usually isn't a very good idea to do that. People get too wired into one thing.
Mrs. Beck?
On page 2, line 27, again, it says the courts shall schedule an informal hearing as promptly. Do you think it might be desirable to put in a timeline there, too?
Yes.
I'm familiar with the difficulties.
Yes. You mean within 30 days?
Within so many days after receiving the complaint.
Yes.
Okay. The other question I have is on the rules of court that we're changing. Can you tell me what they say?
I don't know what they would be, except the ones mentioned in section 3.
That's what I mean. What are they?
I don't really know. The people upstairs did that. I would imagine it would have to do with them.
Do you want to help filing fees and,
yeah.
4D7 deals with service of process on estate. 7B deals with notice of appeal. 9.1 deals with filing fee in Supreme Court. And Administrative Rule 11 deals with filing fee in Superior Court. And a couple of the questions I have will relate to that Section 3.
Lisa, did
Thank
you have
you.
Further questions?
Thank you, that's all.
Thank you, Art.
Mr. Chairman, one thing, in partial response to couple of previous questions. One thing is that instead of dictating how the judge is assigned, which I guess the CJA probably ought to decide that anyhow, but you could say that these cases shall have priority during the time that the judge is assigned to sit in that court or something like that. In other words, what you want to do is get around this notion of putting it off for 10 years. It's really about 2 years, but that's long enough. Mr. Pratt.
Well, Mr. Chairman, trying to do that legally is what concerns me, and I want to ask Mr. Cooper about that. Do you feel that we can actually put in an effective provision with regard to the priority of scheduling without interfering with the administrative power of the court? And also, do you feel that the amending of an administrative rule like Rule 11 is constitutional? You know, there's a case that says that we can amend procedural rules, but not administrative rules.
Well, I think probably legislature can amend any rule of court that it wants to with a two-thirds vote, but I don't know if we want to get into that kind of a situation. I think that the court will, as long as we make clear what our intention is, I think, and we supply whatever extra money is needed to do this, that they'll do it. I don't think that court system is going to do something underhanded to try to undercut our purpose here.
Mr. Chairman, again, let me ask Cooper about this. There's a provision in Title 34 right now with regard to the calendaring of cases involving the foreclosure of mechanics and materialmen's liens. It's been there since 62 and before. Mm-hmm. It says that these cases shall take priority in the calendaring of cases. Has it been your experience that provision is respected at all by the courts?
I don't know anything about mechanics.
In fact, in my experience, just that it has not. And that you can go ahead and tell the courts all you want that the statute says that these cases will have priority, and they still say, well, I'm sorry, we've got a 4-month rule on speedy trial on criminal cases. We got a bunch of criminal cases to worry about. I agree with you. I'd like to accomplish what's in the bill. My problem is doing it in a way so that what you're saying should happen really will happen, and also doing it in a way so that the court doesn't feel that it's a constitutional confrontation over the issue of whether or not we can amend their administrative rules of court.
Well, I'd say maybe the best thing to do is to get is ask a representative of the court system to see what they have to say about it. I've talked to Mr. Snowden about it. He is developing some kind of a position paper on it, and he's going to send it in.
A position paper on the bill. Is he going to send a fiscal note also?
Yeah, I suppose to.
Mr. Lyason?
We better request that, though, Terry. I don't know if he understood the fiscal note.
We'll request that.
Okay.
I was just wondering if this parallels or preempts any of the duties of the ombudsman.
I don't think so, Jake. I think the ombudsman is mostly to shake up the bureaucracy when they're not doing their job. I don't know if the ombudsman has any standing to challenge a regulation as being unconstitutional or any of that. I imagine he could advise his client to do it.
I think the only thing he'd have jurisdiction over is the application, you know, of some regulation or rule of the administration, you know, in the format of whether they discriminatorily applied it to the guy or something like that.
Like page 2, number 3, would that be fall within the boundaries of that?
Or as applied to the petitioner, it might.
But you don't anticipate any problems, any overlapping?
I don't see any, Dick. Maybe conceivably it could be, but I don't think that it is.
Yeah. The question, I think we were talking about Brown's question, or what you were discussing. So, number one, I think this is probably one of the best pieces of legislation we have so far as the best of the problem. But at any rate, is there any way that you could put in there, before you can't tell the court how to do something, is there any penalty you can put in the sense to the state of the citizen if you can't get any attention from the court for 6 months? If they don't act within a certain period of time, 60 days or 90 days, this or that happens. Any way to rush it along. Like they do, if you don't back out
4 months,
you're in trouble.
Oh,
maybe we can say 6 days
and
the regulation
is
the
regulation. Ed, you've got a good line there, boy. We could use a boy like you and our plan. Yes, there's a beautiful thing we could do, and it'd be absolutely constitutional. And it wouldn't even involve, that is, that if the court did not address the matter within a certain amount of time, that the... this would be your club. The regulation would be void.
But that doesn't teach the court a lesson. That hammers the administrative agency.
Well, it sure causes a lot of incentive.
Wait a minute.
The race a little more then.
Let's come back to it. Okay. More questions for Mr. Cooper.
Well, I'm not too discussing that.
Well, okay.
Well, Mr. Cooper is pretty good.
All the same is that.
Well, I'm going to ask you.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll ask you. You got a black free way around here, Steve.
What
would happen, though, if is there any way in the court system that you know of, if you said that this isn't acted on in 60 days, that the person can get an injunction to stop the regulation until such time as there is a hearing? Not to do away with the regulation, but some mechanism that if they don't act in 60 days, that's grounds for getting an injunction to hold off the enforcement until such time as you have
it. I don't see why you couldn't do that. But
you do it anyway.
No, I think you'd have to put in a separate procedure because the whole injunctive procedure is really long and involved.
Maybe the mind has not good, but I can just see, like you say, they'll keep putting this thing off and off until we haven't got time to get into regulation.
Well, they shouldn't. If the Chief Justice assigns a judge to sit 2 days a month, we'll say, or, you know, depending on the volume in that particular area, if the judge assigns Chief Justice assigns a judge to sit 2 days, and it's clear that's what he's supposed to do in that 2 days. He doesn't go off and have murder trials and stuff. I think there wouldn't be any problem. But maybe we ought to put something in there that would provide an electric prod.
Mr. Brown?
Well, the less violent version of what I thought of, inspired by the gentleman from Anchorage here, if some period, say, even past this 30, 60 day, give them a little zilch factor, like, you know, if no action, well, it's 120 days, let's figure anyway, and give them a little extra leeway. If there's been no determination made, say, within 120 days, just have the regulation itself suspended until such time as there has been a determination by the court. And we can do that with regard to our delegation of authority to the agencies, and we're not interfering with the court's administrative rulemaking power.
Well, the trouble with that, as I said, Mr. Chairman, the trouble with that, as I see it, is that if people are proceeding in good faith, they want an answer to these questions. And if you can say that the thing's suspended and everything for 4 or 5 years, but if a guy is trying to get a timber permit or something like that, and he's attacking a regulation that may be unconstitutional, he doesn't care whether the thing doesn't apply for the next 4 months. He wants to know whether it's going to apply to him at all. In other words, just the suspending of it may mean that he can run his operation for a month or a year until the judge gets around to deciding it. But he wants to know once and for all.
Well, Well, Mr. Cooper, don't you think that if this were in there, that it would really address the behavior of the judiciary and the administration? That is, it wouldn't happen that no assistant attorney general is going to sit on his butt if he's going to have a regulation suspended simply because a judge is not moving a case along. I'm just thinking of something that creates an incentive, that is a real incentive for expeditious treatment, that does not involve any arguable interference with the administrative power of the courts over the court system.
Well, the way I look at it, Mr. Brown, as chairman, is that if we set this up right and the people, you know, deal in good faith with it, and the judge is assigned to do this duty, then there shouldn't be that kind of a problem where you have to put a, you know, hold a gun to somebody's head. But in other words, if the Chief Justice assigns a Superior Court judge to sit on April the 15th and 16th on administrative cases,
this bill doesn't say that.
That's what I say. Maybe it ought to be in there.
And I'm saying if you put it in there, you may be going across the line, and we're not amending the rules of procedure. We may be amending rules which involve the administration of the court system, and then you're into a constitutional confrontation with the Supreme Court as to whether or not we can do that. And there's at least one case that says we can't.
Well, okay, well, look, you know, that's pretty extreme, all that. I mean, I think that, I suppose everything's got some kind of potential constitutional conflict in some places. Somebody wants to look at it that way, but I just think that if we do this with understanding the court system, that they'll administer it in good faith, and if they don't, you can always come back and, jerking around a little bit.
Well, Steve, at the very least,
I can Steve, did you envision that there would be one Superior Court judge appointed statewide who, or one in each district?
No, what I was thinking of was that the Chief Justice could, or whoever they decided, but would assign, say, a judge in Anchorage, okay? Maybe he'd assign Judge Ripley to sit as the administrative law judge on April 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th, or the week of April 15th, or something like that. At that time, all of these types of cases would be heard during that week before Judge Ripley. He would make a decision within 30 days with the help of a clerk who's, or other people who are assigned to help the administrative law judge. He'd submit the opinions, and that would be it. If there's one in Fairbanks, somebody would come in and submit a petition for a hearing. The hearing petition would be sent to the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice would say, aha, I see I've got three petitions here. We'll assign Judge Taylor to sit as an administrative law clerk for 3 days, you know, and he would hear those things within, say, 45 days.
Okay, so you do envision that assigning judges in the local areas?
Yeah.
And then, well, what about the other areas where you don't have a judge sitting?
Well, you got the same problem as you do, you know, I mean, people have to come in where there is a judge, I guess.
Okay, but you don't envision appointing any more judges, but it's assigning, basically what we're doing is we're going to take the existing judges a certain amount of their time to this function.
Yeah.
Larry?
Well, I was just going to suggest it may be cruel, but I had the solution. For each week of delay, of course, I want, and this is a question, for each week of delay past the set time, the Chief Justice forfeits a day of vacation.
He won't like that, Larry.
Right?
I play basketball with him.
Those Superior Court judges really hustle out there, though.
Okay, is there any more questions for Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Cooper, okay, we don't go to the extremes, the amendment I was suggesting, Mr. Bancroft was suggesting. I would hope that in the very least that if we pass this or some version of it, that the suggested, if you want to call it that, the suggested procedure that you've described to the committee, okay, here's how it would work, that's really not in the bill. The bill could be read in another way, and somebody could interpret the bill as just another civil action, and technically it has priority, and it'll get infinitely postponed as though it were a lien case. Suppose the current Chief Justice gets run over by a railroad train tomorrow, you know, we got to worry about whoever happens to be sitting up there. I would hope that that procedure could be outlined in a letter of intent to a committee at the very least.
Well, I would think the best way to proceed would be to ask the court system whether the whether they would be ready to adopt rules that would provide that, and if they're not, you know, I don't think the court system means to fight, you know, all down the line on this thing. If they adopt Supreme Court rules of procedure, the Supreme Court adopts the rules of procedure, then we don't have anything to worry about. Otherwise, I guess we'll have to write it in the bill and pass it by a two-thirds margin.
Now, what I was talking about was the procedure you suggested, which really is not, I contend, in the bill.
It isn't.
In the very least, be described as in our committee letter of intent, for instance, showing that this is how this could work, based upon our understanding, something of that.
Oh, yeah. I do think the court system has got to, that we have to get a commitment from the court system to adopt rules that are consistent with the purpose of the legislation here. Otherwise, you are going to have to put it in the legislation. I didn't put it in because I thought you could just do it, you know, by talking to Chief Justice Bucci. He's been very responsive, frankly, to things like this and new ideas. And I don't want to come in and, you know, say, you know, threaten to change all his rules on him and all that kind of stuff. I think he would be amenable to, you know, initiating a change through court rules.
Well, if we could find out what kind of rules would be consistent with the current view of those who administer the court system, and then we could just have a letter of intent saying that this anticipates that rules would be established and describe approximately what they would have in mind anyway, we'd avoid a confrontation, but there'd still be some legislative history guidance as to what this is all about for somebody 5 or 10 years from now.
Sure. Any more questions for Mr. Cooper?
Okay.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Peterson,
would you like to testify? For the record, I'm Art Peterson, Assistant Attorney General. We have no particular position on this bill. We do generally support what appears to be the basic purpose of making judicial remedies more accessible to the people. I would like to comment on a couple of specific points in the bill that seem to raise questions. For example, on page 2, in C3, lines 7 and 8, one ground for invalidating a regulation would be that the regulation is unreasonable per se or as applied to the petitioner. That latter part seems, in fact, the whole paragraph embodies a constitutional type of analysis that I think is not entirely appropriate here. In the constitutional analysis, one considers whether something is unconstitutional per se or as applied. In this instance, we're talking about a different concept of reasonableness, and I would imagine most individuals who even think of challenging a regulation are going to say that it's unreasonable to apply it to them. And we can foresee numerous situations involving a great deal of court time where individuals will be objecting that a reasonable regulation applicable to everybody generally and equally, and for good purpose, protection of state resources, highways, whatever it may be, is invalid as to this person because it's unreasonable as to him. I think that's a little bit of an inappropriate standard and will pose some problems. One of those problems would be in conjunction with the application of subsection D. It says the court shall annul a regulation determined to be invalid under C of this section. Okay, C includes that paragraph 3 I just read. If the court finds that the regulation is not unreasonable per se, not unconstitutional, has been properly adopted, etc., but is only unreasonable as applied to this individual, then clearly I don't think it would be your intent or probably the sponsor's intent to have the court annul that regulation. So if you are going for this basic concept, I would suggest you might want to adopt some language amending that subsection D to make clear that if you're are going to leave in the or as applied to language in C3, you talk about maybe a suspension or shall enjoin application of the regulation to that individual in D, rather than talk about annulment. One of the other points, in section 3, on page 3, it states that portions of Section 2 amend the following rules of court, and it mentions Civil Rule 4D7, which, as I mentioned earlier, deals with service of process on the state. And I don't quite see how this does. I assume that when a person brings this action, under the system set up in the court, using a form established by the court, he nevertheless will have to file process, serve process in the same way as provided in the court rules. And I would like to ask the sponsor if that was the intent or what.
Mr. Chairman, let's think. I have to say that in spite of Mr. Brown's kind remarks, I hadn't been a real lawyer in about 4 years, but it was certainly, at one time, it was a case, if you file suit against the state, you had to get process served on the Attorney General. How you did that was you paid a police officer, and you spent a hell of a lot of money sending a piece of process down here to the police officer in Juneau, and if, whenever he got the time, he might or might not bring it over to the Attorney General's office, and the whole goddamn process took about 3 months sometimes. There's no reason at all why the Attorney General can't get proper notice just by regular mail. Maybe, you know, you can do that legally now, but I know at one time you had to actually have a process server cart the complaint over to the Attorney General, and trying to get that done in Juneau when you're in Fairbanks or Anchorage or Nome was next to impossible. You know, it took sometimes literally 3 months to get the piece of paper delivered. And I know people who served it themselves who sent process servers from Anchorage at their own expense to Juneau in order to properly serve it on the Attorney General.
I believe that is possible to do by mail now. If your staff wanted to check Rule 4 and Rule 5, and maybe 6, so it would be relevant. So that...
You're talking about Civil Rule 4, 5.
Yeah, the reference, right, the reference to 4D7 here is one that deals with service of process on the state, and there are related provisions in 5, and I believe in 6 as well, but at any rate, process service by mail is okay now. There was an amendment of 4 that dealt with the mail issue, and you can serve process outside the state, in state, et cetera, by mail, certified mail. So apart from whether you can do that, I see nothing in the bill that changes that. So I'm wondering what the reference to 47 in Section 3 means. Then the reference to Administrative Rule 11, as Representative Brown was mentioning earlier, the Constitution in the section providing for adoption of court rules and legislative amendment or where there is change of court rules by two-thirds vote, does distinguish between rules of practice and procedure on the one hand and rules of administration on the other hand. If you follow that through the succession of versions in the Constitutional Convention, find at one time it was all one sentence and with one reference to legislative change. In the final version that was finally adopted by the Convention, that was separated into two sentences, and the legislative change provision applies to the rules of practice and procedure part. So I think that may pose a slight problem, and I think you could easily work your way around that with some amendment of the bill. So I don't think it's an insurmountable problem for the bill.
What's Administrative Rule 11?
That's the one that deals with filing fees in the Superior Court.
Do you think there's a way we can do something with filing fees without amending Administrative Rule 11?
I think there might be. I do not have one presently in mind.
What if we call it something else other than a filing fee?
Well,
a devious tax of my
time. Mr. Chairman, I think that's part of the bill, the filing fee. So, I don't know how to get around that. But.
At any rate, that would appear to be a problem with the bill. Then I would just offer a couple of comments on some of the discussion concerning this subsection H on page 2. First, I would suggest apparently what you've already agreed to is contacting the administrative director of courts, because only somebody from the court system, I think, is really sufficiently familiar with the way in which calendaring works, the way in which any particular legislative requirement would affect the handling of court decisions. And I would urge that the committee do contact that and consider that carefully, because as I mentioned earlier, the bill's basic purpose seems laudable, and it would be unfortunate to get it hung up with some technical problem that the court has with the administration of it. And one of the approaches that had been tried addressing Mr. Dankworth's point was specifying, I think, a 6-month period for general cases, judges both at the superior and the Supreme Court level had to have something resolved within 6 months or they would not receive their salary warrant. And I believe the court generally regards that as invalid. No, his was the vacation suggestion.
Oh,
I was referring to you as having raised the question of what approach, what handle could we get on getting into to do something. And I think that the court would probably simply hold something like that in
balance. I think actually they do pretty much stick to the 6 months.
I think they try to, but I think they have the fit. One thing they do, they reassign cases sometimes if it's been assigned for 6 months. Like I have one pending in the Supremes for 8 months now, and no word at all. So they reassign. There are ways of getting around.
You haven't tried to push it, then?
Well, I'm not the appellant. I'm not representing the appellant. I think that would be his job to push it. That case, incidentally, is one involving legislative procedures where the executive branch is, in fact, defending the legislature. It's on the it's on a practice that no longer obtains in the legislature, at least according to your revised uniform rules,
the
voice votes, adoption of free conference reports.
What bill is that on?
Pardon?
What bill is that on?
Well, I've actually got two now. The one that's in the Supreme Court is the one on the lien law. It was adopted in 74, I believe it was. And in addition to rather strange writing of the amendment, one of the houses adopted the free conference report by voice vote, and the other side is claiming both that it's unconstitutionally vague, ambiguous, unclear, etc., and that it doesn't even exist because it wasn't properly enacted by the
legislature. Well, that didn't go through argument.
I won't answer. Then the other one that I just got, which is in the Superior Court, involves the medical malpractice expert panel. And we'll be using essentially the same arguments.
You're saying because we had a voice vote on the conference.
The basic argument is that the Constitution says that the yeas and nays should be recorded on final passage. The question is, what is final passage? Is it when the House adopts a free conference report and thus adopts the final form of a bill, or is it third reading? And the Constitution deals with the term in the context of it being third reading. Okay. That's all I had on this bill. We don't oppose it, but we would urge that you address certain detailed problems that we see raised by the bill.
Any questions from Mr. Peterson? Mr. Mott.
Yeah, just very quickly, what's the ballot rule 7B and 9-1 again?
7B, it deals with notice of appeal. And 9-1 deals with the filing fee in the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to, before we have the dog next time, we're going to get a fiscal note from the court system. We'll also have the court system down here to testify. And I guess we need to check out the issue of Civil Rule 4B7 to find out whether that's necessary anymore. And also a question of Administrative Rule 11 and the filing system. There was a bunch of other amendments suggested, but I think they're pretty technical, and we'll have one of the attorneys down there to work with us at the next meeting. Larry?
I wanted to note that I disagreed with Mr. Peterson's comments in regard to C3.
I think he did have a good point, though, that if you have 3 in there, you've got to do something different with D, that you do have to provide that if the finding was number 3, that the regulation was unreasonable as applied to that particular person, and you don't want to annul it. What you want to do is have the court, enjoin the application of the regulation to that individual and say, this is not applicable to you, or throw out the case as it affects the individual, not throw out the whole regulation.
Would that lead, Mr. Chairman, for me to go in and there's a whole group of us don't like the regulation and that's how it is, and they say, okay, we'll let you off the hook, but everybody else is still stuck with it. Would we have to each one do that?
I think what you structure it so it depends on what basis you contest it. If you contest it as being unconstitutional, see, that's what those 4 things are there.
Yeah,
it's the what basis. Now, maybe they could find it was invalid on several bases.
But if I say it's just unreasonable per se, they have a regulation that I can't put you down in certain areas of the state, or whatever it happens to be, it's just an unreasonable.
I think then that's like saying it's unconstitutional. I think so. See, that's different than saying it's unreasonable as applied to the petitioner. That's the application of it as opposed to being. I'm not really sure what legally unreasonable per se means.
Well,
And would you tell us, you know, come down with that deal not to ask for two more deputies? Because that we don't want to put a bunch of deputies for you. He makes offer.
Or any more jail, here.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, so we're done early again. We're
bye!
So 2 days in a run, in a row before 4 o'clock. We're so good. So a lot of crappy that committee. We'll go down history.
Sure. House Judiciary Committee meeting, March 8th, 1978.
We call a meeting to order. Today is the first bill we have up.
And Fred Brown is here early.
That relates to increasing the small claims jurisdictional.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Pull up to the trial here. The table. The Judiciary Committee again.
Won't take much of your time. It's a very simple bill that does what the legislature did in 1970, and that is increase the amount of small claims jurisdiction.
Senate Bill 137.
For the record, my name is Pat Rohde. The bill increases the amount of jurisdiction from $1,000 to $2,000. Since 1970, when the amount was last amended from $500 to $1,000, the Bureau of Labor Statistics Index indicates that the cost of living has gone up 55%. All we're doing is keeping pace with inflation. It would not be unreasonable to increase the amount of small claims jurisdiction even further to $2,500 to account for the period of time before the legislature will attend to this matter next. I'd be happy to entertain any questions. It's a very straightforward bill.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Well, this means that if right now somebody has a claim for over $1,000 that they end up having to go through
Superior Court.
So this will keep a little bit of work out of the Superior Court.
Everything we can do to streamline the small claims court is for the best. The Legislative Affairs will be doing a study this summer on small claims court to propose some possible suggestions to make it easier for an average person to get into small claims court. We found that because of several Supreme Court decisions, but more importantly, just through the normal growth of bureaucracy, it's become increasingly difficult for an average person to go into small claims court to present their own case. The paperwork and especially some of the procedural requirements are particularly telling on the people who do go into small claims court. Hopefully, when the 11th legislature begins, we'll have a report from the Legislative Affairs as part of their interim work. This is a study that will take into account the recommendations of the Chamber of Commerce, the National Chamber of Commerce, a study on the Bar Association, various public service groups, Alaska Legal Services, et cetera, hopefully arrive at a product that will provide the ordinary Alaskan with much better access to the court system. And that's one of the big criticisms of justice today, is that there's very limited access. And as an attorney, I can assure you that it is precisely that. There is limited access.
Questions from other people? What does this do to the caseload of small claims court? Do we know what relationship the area $1,000 to $2,000 claims have?
It's difficult to tell because we're only guessing. I suspect that it will not change the statistics a great deal. We'll probably see an initial jump and then a normal increase in caseload that will parallel other areas of the court system. Generally, the small claims cases are in many ways no different from Superior Court cases. Both reflect the economic tenor of the times. And with few exceptions, I think you'll see similar patterns overall, because similar social events and economic events cause the controversies, whether they're more important or at least larger dollar amounts that are Superior Court, or smaller dollar amounts that go into District Court.
Has the court system commented on
that idea? I've talked informally with members of the court system, with District Court judges, and everybody is in agreement that it's a mere housekeeping bill to keep pace with inflation. Actually provides in 1978 dollars what was the same sort of jurisdiction that was formerly provided in 1980 dollars of changes. There is no opposition to my knowledge.
Any other members?
Move
the bill.
So
the motion to move out Senate Bill 137. Is there any objection to the motion?
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
You owe me one, Pat.
I owe you several, probably, Fred.
Okay, the next bill we're going to have is House Bill 582. It's almost the first bill.
Fish bill, finally.
It's amazing the way fishermen get treated in this city.
Not even Friday.
Almost as well as.
You
know what? Oh, no, my gosh.
Oh, sure.
I've already paid. I'm Grace Wilson, the administrator.
Okay. Mr. Wilson, would you like to
come
up? House Bill 582.
Does everybody have a copy of this bill?
Should also be a cover letter from the governor and a fiscal note.
Are we passing?
Well, you're marking.
They should go by the recommendations or whatever they're.
Colin said do pass. You have to read where it's trying to find. Okay, Mrs. Wilson, go ahead.
A little bit of background on Fisherman's Fund. It was established in 1951 to provide some medical care for those fishermen not covered by workman's compensation. The revenue is derived from the sale of the commercial fishing license, and it's 60% of the license, sale of the license. And so at the present time, $6 a year from the state and $18 from the out-of-state commercial fishermen. Gold from the Fisherman's Fund. This covers the administration as well as the claims for the medical care. It was written territorial waters of the state in the original statute. It continued on that. Although I think in practice, probably in the last 8 or 10 years, they were paying claims out to the 12-mile limit because they were Alaska fishermen selling their fish in Alaska, covered by the fishing license. When I questioned the Fisherman's Fund Advisory Council on what effect the 200-mile limit would have, they said go to the Attorney General's office and request, which I did, and he at that time designated that the territorial waters of the state meant the 3-mile limit, which means all those fishing outside the 3-mile limit were no longer covered by Fisherman's Fund if they had an accident out of high sea, which probably eliminates quite a few at this time. You have to realize back in the earlier days, most of the fishing in Alaska was done on the coastal waters within the 3 mile, so it didn't discriminate against them. So by amending it to be as it does, the Alaska waters mean the inland and territorial waters of the state and the fisheries conservation zone adjacent to the state, as established by the Section 1 of the Fisheries Conservation Management Act of 1976. All fishermen who have the crew member's license or the gear permit would now be covered by Fisherman's Fund. As of present time, it's almost impossible. We just have two on the staff. We do not have time or the means to investigate if they want to lie about where they were. And I have a feeling that sometimes we're creating that all the accidents are happening within the 3-mile limit, but we don't know. We just change their story if they know this. On the other hand,
I thought you were finished.
We don't know how many accidents are not being reported to us just because they are aware of the limit.
Mr. Miles.
I have the foggiest idea what the Fisherman's Fund is. Is that an insurance fund that pays for
it's a medical disability? On the job, if you're out fishing, it's funny, but if I cut your hand off something, they'll pay for flying in and fixing it for an accident.
How about for, does that also pay for, let's say you're permanently disabled, does that give you $800?
No, there's no provision. Limited, as I said, the revenue is only $6 a year from each state license, so it's limited to
to $2,500
per
accident or illness.
Okay, and who pays fishermen? If this is pre-statehood, it's a dedicated fund. You buy a fishing license every year for $10, and $6 of it goes into the fisherman's fund. And then
so sport fishermen is paying for this?
Yeah, it's commercial. You have to buy a $10 personal commercial fishing license. See, you buy a license for the person, and each crew member buys a license. And then you buy a license for your boat, and a license for your gear. And it costs about $50. See, it says fisherman is entitled to emergency treatment, transportation to the nearest place where approved medical facilities are available, medical care, and hospitalization. So it's kind of a self-funding thing. There's no general funds that goes in.
Right. Even my even administration is paid for by the fund.
And it's all from the fishing permits?
No, from license.
Permits,
yeah, by those extra.
At this time, this year.
It's another 50.
Well, no, at this year, the gear permit does, they take out the amount of money, $6, from that in the
because
combined licensing.
Right.
But the crew members still have.
Okay, $6.
Who
administers?
Who administers? Department of Labor.
Isn't there an advisory board or something?
Yeah, with an advisory and appeals council.
Fishermen
from five different districts.
You got anything else besides this bill? Well, we may have one possible amendment to this. Representative Elias,
away before I did, and I was going to.
Representative Elias reminded me that we had a bill in once before to raise the limit. The total allowance is like $2,500. That's
mm-hmm.
all you can get. And so if your medical costs go above that, you have to pick it up yourself. And how much was that going to raise it to
Well, we don't have an act. You mean raising the limit?
Yeah, because we had some legislation in before, and it passed the House, but it didn't pass the Senate. And I even thought it had passed the Senate, but because the fund actually is growing, the amount in the fund, the surplus is growing each year, so we could afford to raise it somewhat. Because there are, I had a case with. One of the guys I know, he had a back injury that was more like $10,000.
Okay. May I speak?
Yes, sure.
At this point, 3 years ago I would have spoken in favor of this. At this point, I think I could speak against it because the costs are growing so. And now with the fishing on the high sea, the accidents out there are very, very serious as a rule, and the protection and indemnity insurance are really looking to fishermen's fund for every dime they can get because it saves them that much money. I mean, there are many, many claims that go over that, but if you raise it to $5,000, they're going to get the whole $5,000 before they're going to pay a dime into it. I mean, that was the proposed limit before, and I really think you're going to find you might deplete the fund very rapidly.
I guess that's the question. Is we looked at it before, so we could without the Mr. Lyons.
Well, I believe it was an administration.
Yeah.
Administration bill, and what was the rationale at that particular time?
Well, at that time, the number of claims being handled were relatively small because. Well, many of these facilities, medical facilities, just were not sending in claims. The amount being paid out in claims and grants was very, very small. You know, the revenue was being built up very rapidly. Since that time, there are more claims being filed. And another thing is that all these bigger vessels are covered, you know, documented vessels are covered under public health. And are covered under the protection and indemnity insurance most of the time. Whereas I feel that when they do have a serious accident, it can be picked up by the other insurance companies or public health.
Is that the figures on the increase?
That's the balance sheet.
This is actually, the only deficit year was the first year. Since then, there's been accumulating a surplus in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10,
they're telling for.
What's happening in the last...
In 14 years, they picked up 653,000 surplus.
There was a surplus last year, too?
Surplus every year, except for the first year.
And
no,
probably
the
not,
first year, I thought, right?
Probably not this year. I was just telling Judy Knight, our administrative officer, that...
Well, I think, you know, really, Mr. Chairman, that... besides that insurance policies the fishermen are required to have, I think the problem is, it's, you know, we're not going to change one thing, is that the cost of the medical expense has gone up. And it's, it seems to me that the protection should go up too. Especially if you have just about $750,000 in 14 years surplus. Obviously, you could have paid out higher.
Yeah, they could have. I agree. But at this point, however...
And it seems to me that if it was increased, we'd know within a year or two before we depleted the fund whether we did the right thing or not.
This is true. You would.
And what we're saying then is that, we recognize that there's going to be more people covered, but we also recognize that the costs are higher, so you're going to pay, the fishermen themselves are going to pick up the difference.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of what, Jim?
In terms of,
if the fund became depleted, we'd have to raise the amount of fishermen.
Well, no, what I'm saying is, at the present time, obviously the fishermen are picking up the difference now. She says that the limitations, if they didn't have limitations on now, we might be in a deficit position. I don't know about that, but... So who's picking up that? The fishermen.
Well, right. No, the protection and indemnity insurance is picking up some of that. You're right. There are fishermen who have had to pick it up themselves, and I'm sure it's been a hardship. Public health. I don't know whether they would come in for reimbursement more often or not. I don't know.
What is it proposed?
$5,000.
That's $2,500
now. Yes.
You say that for this fiscal year, though, you don't think there's going to be a surplus.
Well, of course, I have to submit a budget, you know, like any state agent, and the amount that I had proposed, you know, that I thought we could live within, and the grants and claims, I'm coming to the top of it right now. 198,000 is the amount for grants and claims to come out of the budget this year, and I'm right now at 170,000 that has been paid out in FY 78. So obviously I'm being dangerously close.
What were your receipts this year?
Well,
they've already been paid in.
Yeah, the receipts paid in, as you see, were $248,258. So,
well,
that's the budget. That's the receipts I have to work on. What comes in this year, I'll work on next year. Understand?
Okay. Well, so when you say fiscal year 76-77, that's from fishermen's licenses in 1977.
76-77. It's from July 1 of 76.
Well, fishermen buy on a calendar year.
Right, but the revenue comes in on the fiscal year.
Oh.
It's nice. Turned into the fund in a fiscal year.
Okay, so you don't have a projection on your revenue for next year?
I did check, and it's the revenue that has come in since July 1 of 77 to December, through December, was $114,000. But now that's your low time.
Yeah, everybody buys the spring.
Right.
Okay.
So, you know,
I think it'd be a good idea to raise it, but I don't think anybody wants to, you know, run it into a deficit. So I'm not sure what we have to do. Mr. Lyons?
Is there, this receipts that we collect the interest on the balance?
No, and I need to do some research for my own information. But it's my understanding that because it's a dedicated fund, it cannot be invested, therefore, it doesn't earn any interest.
Either $650,000
in a checking account someplace?
I don't.
Well, not a check. I mean,
and don't earn interest?
That's what they keep telling me, in revenue.
God.
Good old Department of Revenue.
Well, then it's in the Department of Labor.
No, the Department of Revenue is the custodian of the fund. The Department of Labor shall administer.
That's right.
well,
what's the legal basis for
because
it's a dedicated fund, they can't go to the bank. You know, 10% to $10,000, that's $42,000 a year.
They told me, some person told me when I asked that question, that it's because we made a poor investment.
Balance plus the receipt and subtracting the disbursement in the year 75-76 reflects no interest at all.
There's no interest. There's none.
Okay, well, I was just adding it up to...
I can guarantee you that.
Yes.
What's some offsetting to that? The fund itself, is it the same thing there about time deposits or any acts?
Let us ask for a legal opinion.
Doesn't say anything about it.
Obviously, you can't go ahead and invest, you know, buy the Brooklyn Bridge with the damn thing, or invest in stocks or something.
But you should put in some CDs or something.
Yeah,
7 or 6%.
I've already asked this. Judy just asked me a question: how many claims I've had last year, and it was only 900 and some. We've already had 600 and some this year.
Claims? Then they all must be substantially below $2,500.
Oh, a lot of them are. A lot of them emergency room care, you know, fish hooks in the hand and that type of thing. But then you get the real serious ones where Saul loses half of his arm.
Who do you work for? The Department of Labor? Who's your boss then?
Mr. Orbeck.
I mean, is there anybody?
Oh, John, well, at this point I'm in the Workman's Comp Division.
Hasn't anybody looked into the possibilities of receiving interest in these funds?
Yes, they have. So again, as I say, Mr. Craig Bracken, the previous administrator, had.
That just doesn't sound right. Mr. Chairman, why don't we ask somebody for a legal opinion and get revenue in here or something like that? It's ridiculous.
We'll talk to the Department of Revenue and get a legal opinion of our own.
I don't know if we want to hold up the legislation.
The only thing is, it does kind of reflect on if we were receiving interest, that would make it look a lot better fiscally for raising the limit. So we'll try to do that in the next couple of days. We're not going to get an easy answer. Let's see. I guess would you give Mr. Speed, our administrative assistant here, the figures for this year, so we can if you have it done,
didn't bring that copy. We're going to give you the exact figures of revenue income, or
what you project. I guess a copy of your budget, because that's what you said you project under there, what your disbursement.
Okay, I would have to bring that back to you because I didn't bring a copy of
that's
my budget
fine.
With me.
All right.
I had it out this morning.
When it says over here, you've got receipts and then disbursements. Does that include the administrative costs?
Yes,
that's the total.
Yes.
All right, good. So you can give it that just for FY78, what you're projecting.
Uh-huh.
And then...
You want my up-to-date amount of expenditure, too?
Yeah, I want what the actual FY77 and the projected FY78. Okay. Mr. Lassen?
Are you also going to get the same that at least the maximum and how much in excess?
Yeah, maybe you could give that to us, a breakdown. You have a breakdown written up on the, so many in this dollar category.
Yes, I can get a computer readout fairly soon on FY78. I had 75 is already prepared. I mean, I know that.
Uh-huh.
But
we'd just like a gross breakdown. I think 10% of them are under this figure.
Oh, all right.
What percent of your total claims are at 25,000?
A much larger percentage than ever before are running at 25,000. I know one time when I had the billing before, I had gone through that and found it was very, very low.
I forget the reasoning you withdrew support in the bill about 3 years ago. I thought it had something to do with entry somehow or other. That was the reason somebody gave, I think.
Maybe, but the other thing was that I was afraid of the protection and indemnity attorneys of their usage of the funds.
Because what they're saying is that this comes first.
Well, sure, take what Fisherman's Fund will pay first, and then we'll pay what's left over, you know?
That's not reflected in our P&I rates, is it?
Oh, I'm sure it's not.
Simple,
just
having 7% here. $400,000.
Right.
That's not compounded. Simple interest. Just 7% a year added year to year, that was compounded substantially higher. Ballpark figure.
Which is, yeah.
That's the
time. No, I mean, we'll get the $400,000.
Yeah, imagine 8 months that he runs, you know, not drawing interest.
I'm sure he's just government. Doled it into the state surplus fund. Thank you, Mrs. Wilson. We'll get the information tomorrow, so we're adjourned for today.
House Judiciary Committee meeting for March 9th, 1978, adjourned at 3:35 p.m.